Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another terrifying episode of Hollywood Week, The Breakdown. My name is Keenan Culler, and I am joined once again by the heart of Chicago, the Almost Doctor, and the Almost Doctor Loomis? It's Kaysen Culler. Kaysen, how you doing tonight?
What's up, Keenan? I'm doing good. I just got to watch this movie we're breaking down last night, so I'm excited to talk about it. And Halloween's coming up, man. Are you ready?
Kaysen, I'm so ready. I don't have a costume quite yet, but I'm trying to decide between like sexy male nurse or Rudy Giuliani. I'm going back and forth between both those options.
I mean, you could probably use similar components for both those, right? Not too far apart.
Yeah, or Kaysen, actually the perfect Halloween costume would be Hunter Biden because you don't have to wear any clothes and you just walk around with a crack pipe.
Yeah, pretty much already dress up as him anyway.
Kaysen, that's topical humor right there off the top of the show.
There you go. We're bringing it. We're bringing it while we still can before November 3rd comes and tensions are higher.
Yeah, I was going to say, we can still make those jokes before we emerge into a civil war and all humor is lost forever.
Exactly. Come November, no matter what happens, no matter who wins, a lot of people are just going to be in a state of like chronic anger for, I would say, at least 6 months.
That's when the real horror movie begins.
Exactly, yeah. The coronavirus winter post-election of 2020.
Hey, last...
Everyone brace yourselves.
I don't know if you checked out the debate, but the last debate on, I think it was last Friday. But
Thursday.
Joe Biden kept bringing up with COVID that we were going to enter like a dark winter.
Were you thinking of Game of Thrones?
That's all I was thinking about. And I swear, I was just thinking, like, what if Trump right now looked at him and he's like, hey, like, Jon Snow, take it easy, John. Take it easy, John. Like,
what if he said, you know nothing, Joe Biden?
Oh, my gosh, man.
Yeah.
If only.
Yeah.
Anyway, Kaysen, tonight's episode is another episode of The Breakdown, where we're taking a classic, iconic film, dissecting it and seeing what makes it so special. And as you alluded to, tonight's episode couldn't be more timely. It is the Disney Channel original film, Halloween Town.
Perfect. I love
that. Wait. I'm wrong. It's the 1978 John Carpenter horror classic, Halloween. Much better.
Oh, gosh. I thought we were sticking to only classics here, Keenan.
Yeah.
I didn't know we were scraping the bottom of the barrel with this.
Just to be safe, I watch both movies, so in case, you know, we decide to go one direction or the other.
Yeah, I think that was a good decision, because who knows where we could spiral off into here.
Anyway, all jokes aside, we are breaking down the 1978 classic Halloween, the debut of one of the most iconic slashers, the most iconic villains, I would say, in film history, Michael Myers.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Excited about that. But Kaysen, before we get into any of this, I gotta tell you, I told you before we started recording, I'm not feeling the best.
Took a trip. You got the Rona?
I took a trip to Michigan this past weekend. I gotta get up there and hang out with Kid Rock, Jack White, Eminem. But Jeff Daniels. But so when we were all partying up there, I got a little bit stuffy, man. And I thought, because you're the Almost Doctor, maybe I could rattle off some symptoms to you and just real quick tell me the likelihood of it being COVID.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because I feel like our listeners out there, if they're experiencing some of these symptoms, don't panic. Because we don't know, but I'm gonna give you my symptoms.
Don't panic yet until I give you the diagnosis.
Exactly. So Almost Doctor, I need you to come through for me. Okay, here we go. Stuffy nose.
Okay.
What do you think?
Oh, you're only giving me one at a time?
Yeah.
I don't think COVID patients have stuffy noses usually. I think that's a good sign.
We're off to a good start. Slight headache.
That could be a lot of things. I feel like I have that every day. So.
Minor body aches.
That sounds like a you problem. That could be COVID, but could also be the flu, could also be just, you know, the gradual decay of your body.
Okay.
Hard to tell.
COVID test that came back positive.
Oh, well, that's pretty reassuring. I hear that 50% of the time you don't actually have it, even if you get that. So
okay, well, look, I'm just throwing it out there. Those are my four symptoms. I got the stuffy nose, I got the body aches, I got the slight headache, and I got the COVID test that came back positive. So we're going to...
Yeah, I'd say you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah, we don't know is what we're trying to say. We don't know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, it's up in the air.
Kaysen, let's move on. And by the way, I don't have COVID. That was a joke.
Yeah.
Anyway, Kaysen.
Hopefully there's no karma coming at you for that joke.
I just immediately get severe COVID.
Yeah, you just start like coughing uncontrollably.
By the end of this episode, I have COVID.
Yeah, we'll keep you safe.
Kaysen, before we dive in to the carnage and the destruction of Michael Myers, let's talk about our social media game because it's going stronger than ever. The Instagram page is actually like Michael Myers. It keeps trying to die, but I won't let it. It just keeps coming back. It keeps coming
let's
back
go.
Stronger than ever. Follow us on Instagram at Hollywood_week. That's guaranteed to be a good time. But Kaysen, our real bread and butter is the Facebook group. I know you love to talk about it. What's going on with the Facebook group?
I do, yeah. Our Facebook group is like our Jamie Lee Curtis. Pretty low expectations going in, but surprisingly a solid performance.
Nice.
Yeah, so Facebook group, we got Hollywood Week over there. Check it out. We have a lot of great discussion about... what movies, let's see what we've been talking about recently. I think what movies or TV series ended prematurely, right? I really like that question. I don't remember who asked that, but got a lot of good responses. And then, of course, with Halloween coming up, there's going to be a lot of talk of best Halloween movies. So get over there if you want to join the conversation.
Kaysen, that question was brought to us by our boy Fatty McGee 37, who never sleeps. This guy lives on the Facebook page. We love him. He's doing good work over there.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Anyway, so that's what we got going on with the social media game. But Kaysen, tonight's episode, I'm gonna try to delay and stall a little less than I normally do. Let's get right into it. This is the breakdown. This is actually our final episode too of our October special. So just to recap real quick before we dive in. First, we did the top 10 horror films of all time. Go back and listen to that. Great. That was a great episode. I like that a lot.
And was this movie on your list?
This movie, I think, was number 6 for me, I want to say. 5 or 6.
That's pretty good.
Kaysen, then we dropped our definitive ranking of the Scream franchise, where speaking of Dr. Loomis, we got his long-lost nephew, Billy Loomis, causing havoc.
I like to believe there's an actual... mythology there where that's true.
Liver alone. Get it? Liver alone. Kaysen, then just last week, just a short 7 days ago, we dropped our review on the Netflix original series, The Haunting of Bly Manor. So if you haven't listened to that, make sure you check that out.
Yeah.
And tonight, it all ends, Kaysen. It all ends. The Halloween fun ends with our definitive, I shouldn't say definitive, but just our breakdown. Of Halloween, the one that started it all. Let's dive right in. Kaysen, Halloween was released on October 27th, 1978. Now, this is the first time I can say neither one of us were born.
No, that is old.
This thing is old, Kaysen. Did this thing have sound at the time? Was it in black and white?
Yeah, this came out when the artist is set.
This came out like in the Martin Scorsese, like when he was a kid. Now, when I would go to the cinemas and watch the pictures, I really liked watching Halloween. Michael Myers, it was my favorite.
This movie inspired him, right?
It absolutely did. Anyway, released on October 27th, 1978, this had a budget of $300,000, but went on to gross $47 million at the U.S. box office. Just for comparison's sake, in 2008, that would be the equivalent of $150 million, which makes Halloween one of the most successful independent films of all time.
That is amazing. And just on that note, since we're in our little October series here, I think it's pretty amazing that horror movies are very unique in their ability to typically be made on a very low budget and then often have humongous returns. Don't you feel like that's kind of unique to like the horror genre?
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I mean, that's why you see, especially like my days at Blockbuster, you see so many horror movies getting churned out. Like so many straight to DVD, like, you know, straight to video on demand, because they're incredibly cheap to make. And most of the time it's fairly easy to turn a profit if you know what you're doing. So look at like the entire formula of like Blumhouse, right?
Right.
Or Blumhouse. I mean, they make inexpensive movies that they know are going to net them, you know, 50, 60 million in the call it a day.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great model for sure.
Exactly. Kaysen, before we get into the positives and negatives, I know it's like, I know it's October, it's late October. I should have this fixed by now, but my watch is still broken. So I need you to tell me what time it is, Kaysen.
We got some trivia time in this episode.
That's right. It's a quarter past trivia time. Here we go.
Oh,
Kaysen,
thank
Halloween.
Goodness.
Halloween was voted the fifth scariest film of all time by Entertainment Weekly.
Do you know when that vote happened?
I don't know because I didn't do enough research. Thanks for bringing attention to it.
No, that's I was genuinely curious. That's interesting. I mean, I definitely would not agree with that, but hey, that's cool.
You know, I can tell this is already going to go in a certain direction, and I don't like it. Kaysen, let's dive right into the positives and negatives of this movie. Why don't you drop your thoughts, your overall thoughts, before we dive into the plot and break this thing down? And also, as we always do, because you're 15 years old, why don't you let us know what is your experience, like what's your history with this movie? Is this the first time you've watched this thing front to back?
No, I've seen this before. I actually remember watching this movie in high school one time because it was Halloween. Like, it was like Halloween week or something. And I realized that I had never seen the original Halloween. And at that point, I was getting kind of more into scary movies. And I was like, I got to check this out. So I have seen it before once, but it was definitely good to refresh it. As far as my overall thoughts on it, I think it's really good. I think especially considering it came out in the 1970s, like it is way ahead of its time. I think there are specific things about the movie that are incredible. And then also specific things about it that whether they are a factor of its age or in my opinion, just kind of a little shaky quality, bring it down a little bit for me. But it's a really, really good movie. The thing is, I don't know if I would call it scary. Like it is scary for sure, but as far as being the fifth scariest movie of all time, I do think it's scary, but I don't even necessarily think being scary, quote-unquote, is like what the movie's strength is, if that makes sense. What do you think?
Interesting. First off, I love this movie. Obviously, I put it as my like around number six horror film of all time. I think this is a classic. This did so much for the slasher genre. This isn't necessarily like the first ever slasher movie, but it's definitely the one I feel like that boosted it and kind of put it on the map. Michael Myers created so many copycats. You had Jason, Freddy, amongst others, but
Ghostface.
Ghostface. I can't wait to talk about Michael Myers once we kind of dive into the plot of this movie. But yeah, I think that I'm surprised you don't think this is scary. I guess my thoughts on this is the type of movie that is all about setting a tone and like a vibe. And I feel like you either get on that wavelength or you don't really get on it. You know, and
yeah.
if it kind of gets its hooks in you with what John Carpenter, the director, was trying to do here, I feel like the entire thing is incredibly unsettling from start to finish. But if you're looking more at it from like a, and I'm not saying you are, I'm just saying in general, if you look at it more from like a modern lens, it's maybe not as scary because we're used to more like immediate, insidious, conjuring type scares, you know, that are a little bit more in your face. This is way more slow paced and way more about setting a tone and an atmosphere.
Sure.
I would say like positives and negatives just from before I turn it back over to you. Number one, I mean, the two biggest positives in this movie both have to do with the director, John Carpenter. Number one, he created the music for this movie, which to me makes the movie. So I was in love with the music. Obviously, the iconic theme. Every time that kicks in, it feels so, so unsettling. And not to mention just the sound effects. Like the weird synthy, like the soundboard, whatever he was using for like certain effects, like when Michael would pop out, different moments, it really gets under your skin. So I got to give a huge shout out to not only the music, but just the sound design in general. And then the second thing is just his camera work. Like the way he moves the camera in this movie, so many like long tracking shots, so many point of view shots, right? Like you really are in the head of Michael Myers, of the characters in the movie. Very like voyeuristic, right? It feels like you are looking into someone's house. And I kind of appreciated that even more this rewatch, where it was like, man, that is what makes it so unsettling. Like, he really does a good job of putting you in that place and that headspace.
Yes. Go ahead.
Real quick, negatives. I just feel like this movie is not at all really about characters. It's very much a, which is, to me, works in its favor. It's very much a simple, stylistic, atmospheric movie. It's not trying to tell some deep layered story. It's not trying to give us crazy, amazing characters. It just is what it is, and that's it.
Okay.
Go ahead. Sorry, I rambled.
Okay. No, that's cool. Did you have any other negatives, or it's pretty much your main one?
I might have more as we talk about the, as we break it down, but why don't I turn it over to you and just kind of get your initial positives, negatives.
Yeah, so I actually pretty much completely agree with every single thing you just said.
Oh, nice.
Which is rare for us in these occasions. Yeah, this movie, I think, has one of the greatest soundtracks of anything ever. Like, undoubtedly.
Hell yeah.
It's a shining example of using music in a movie to, like, set the mood. It's unreal, honestly. Like, the use of the music is so, so good. It's so minimalistic, and, like, he really created little, like, musical, I guess, riffs that don't even necessarily sound like music all the time, you know? They're kind of more just, like, noises happening over and over. And it works so well. Like, it's really creepy. And I kind of like the boldness of the use of the music, because he uses it very, like, aggressively and loudly in situations where the tension is kind of building, and it really gives you an impact factor that I don't think you would have had he been more subtle with his, like, sound effects. Does that make sense? Like, he's very aggressive with it.
It completely makes sense, because he really throws you off as the audience. You know, we get those kind of like, I can't even do a recreation of the little tune that he plays, but just kind of those, that slow, like creepy piano organ tune as like the characters are just walking down the sidewalk. Like, you know, he'll all of a sudden he'll lull you into this kind of unsettling calm. And then Michael will pop out and it'll be this like synthy, like, wah.
Yep. Yep, totally, totally.
Do you agree that every time, and I know we're talking about the music a lot and the sound, but I feel like it really deserves conversation. Don't you think every time they play the theme, it's just like, this is so good.
Yes, absolutely. And I think he used it just the right amount to kind of be the connecting glue throughout the whole movie, without just making it like, okay, this song's just playing all the time. Like,
yeah,
it was very, very well done.
And let's not forget, like, his little like musical cues or his little theme that he plays when Michael is like aggressive, which is just that simple like da da da.
Yes,
you know.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, because I remember that rhythm, but I can't remember exactly what the music sounds like. But specifically, when he starts chasing Jamie Lee Curtis and she's trying to, like, get out the back door, that music is playing. And it's so cool, because during that sequence, you would almost think there would be, like, louder, bigger music, right?
Yeah.
But he almost, like, subverts expectations by, okay, now craziness is happening on screen, but now we're just getting this really unsettling little, like, you know, almost Jaws-like music, like the predator is, like, you know, methodically tracking his prey. It's not, like, frantic like you would expect it to be.
Yeah.
It's cool. Yeah.
So good, man. How about negatives? What do you agree that kind of the characters are a little lacking?
I totally do, but I want to agree with also your point about the camera work. I mean, I won't go into it too much because I totally agree with you, but specifically, the opening to this movie is fantastic from the point of view of young Michael Myers. This is an opening that I can really get behind, unlike the Scream opening, which we've talked about.
Come on.
Very, very creepy. Very well done. And then the other one that I really liked that was a perspective shot is when Jamie Lee Curtis is trying to get the kid she's babysitting to open the door, and she keeps looking over her shoulder at Michael, like, coming out of the other house, walking towards her. And every time the camera just cuts to her point of view and you just see him getting closer and closer. Like, that was making me, you know, feel uneasy, like, just in my seat watching the movie, because you feel like he's coming towards you. You know what I mean? And you can feel that tension of like, oh, he's getting really close, you know, like, open the door, I mean, you stupid kid.
I mean, honestly, that's one of my favorite scenes in the movie. We're going to talk about that a little deeper when we dive in. But it's, again, just the entire idea of Michael Myers is that he is this almost like a force of nature. Like, you can't stop him. And he, the way he methodically walks, the way that we see that shot of him, just like a regular guy would, just walking across the road towards her, closer and closer. It's just like he's this impending doom that you can't escape. And it's so well done.
Yeah, definitely. The characters, I also agree with. Big weakness for me of the movie. I'm cool with Michael Myers being who he is, right? Because he's just kind of like the faceless, like, villain. And I get that that's the whole point of him. Like you said, he's a force of nature. He doesn't need, like, a huge backstory or anything.
Well, real quick, let me interject. Because Rob Zombie, when he remade Halloween, he tried, you know, infamously, to give Michael Myers a backstory as far as being this, you know, abused kind of trailer trash little boy, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, like, that immediately takes away what makes him scary, right? Is the, what makes him scary is you don't, just like the Joker, you don't know what makes him tick. He is just this blank force of nature. By trying to fill in those gaps, it just doesn't work. And I feel like John Carpenter, if you want to say it was a creative choice or he just didn't care enough to give him a backstory, either way, it was, I thought it made him creepier.
Yeah, my problem is I feel like he has to pick one or the other. Like, if you're not going to characterize the villain, then I feel like you need to characterize the victims. And if you're not going to characterize the protagonist, then I feel like you need to characterize the villain. Because what we're left with here, in my opinion, is just kind of a very heartless movie where I don't really get Jamie Lee Curtis's character. I don't really get any of her high school friends. They're very much just like generic, random tropes, you know, like none, like, I mean, they're fine, but I think it would have been better. And something that I think was actually done better in the new version of Halloween from 2018. Not that I'm saying that's a better movie, but just as far as like giving the main characters a little bit of, you know, humanity to me. Totally. I just feel like in this movie, they were very, very dry.
Yeah, and it's not an excuse. It's not like me trying to say that's not a problem. I just think that clearly John Carpenter's intention making this, like, that was the last thing on his mind. You know, he was so focused on like just wanting to make this tense, scary, kind of like creepy ride that he kind of put the characters on the back burner.
You're right. It wasn't about the story. And like, speaking to that point, kind of another negative, I guess, for me is that I really feel like nothing happens in this movie. And I don't know whether or not that's a valid criticism, but just my own experience watching it, like, I literally looked at the timer of the movie and I think it was like 75 minutes into the movie. There were only 15 minutes left. And I was thinking, like, you've got to be kidding me. I seriously feel like this movie just started. You know what I mean? Like, wow. I feel like there should still be another, like, hour of the movie. Because nothing had happened up to that point. Like, it was literally an hour of just kind of, like, you know, babysitting sequences, like, characters walking around at night. And I liked all of it, but I almost feel like there should have been a longer, like, climax to the movie. Like, well, you could have given it an extra half hour.
Why don't we dive into the plot? We'll see if we can talk about nothing, the first hour of nothingness, and see if you're right or if you are completely tripping.
Okay.
Anyway, Kaysen, let's start off with that opening sequence that you said you were a fan of. We get young Michael infamously murdering his sister in her bedroom. Incredible. The minute the movie starts, the very first image we see of the house from little Michael's point of view, seeing him like walk around the side of the house, spying on his sister, on the boyfriend, it feels very ominous. It feels very creepy. I was into it right from the jump.
Yeah, totally. It is really, really disturbing. This is kind of the beginning of like a weird trend in the movie that I don't know how I felt about, which is it almost felt like he was unnecessarily like sexualizing a lot of the female characters, like just in an over the top way.
What?
I don't know if you felt like that. Yeah, like there were. I feel like there was kind of weird nudity
I'm
in the movie.
I'm sorry. You mean John Carpenter? I thought you meant Michael.
Yes.
Okay.
No. I mean John Carpenter. Like, I feel like there were just a lot of shots of like, okay, why is this girl like, you know, brushing her hair in the mirror, like, you know, just like in this weird way, yeah, like not wearing any clothes. I don't know.
It seemed odd to me. It was the 70s. Everyone was Hunter Biden in the 70s. Just,
I guess so. Yeah.
Everyone just flopping around with the crack pipes.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought that up, because later when we get to the character of Annie, when she like spills something on her shirt and then she just takes all of her clothes off for no reason
in the kitchen of her like babysitting kid's house.
Incredibly weird. Don't let me forget to make fun of that later.
Okay, sounds good.
Anyway, so this opening was insane. I love the sequence. I love seeing him go in. We see him get the knife. It, just the way it's filmed, it was so ahead of its time. I love how he gets the mask and immediately our perspective as the audience gets like put through the eye holes of the mask.
Yep.
You know,
totally.
Right up until the moment when after he kills his sister, he walks outside and his parents roll up and unmask him. And did this is a very weird comparison. Did the pan out of this shot remind you of Force Awakens when Rey is like handing the lightsaber to Luke and it like stays on that shot for uncomfortably long where it's like, okay, cut, please.
No, it did not. I mean, I didn't think of that at all, but I see the comparison you're making.
Do you think this is the first time someone has compared Star Wars The Force Awakens to 1978 Halloween?
Yeah, I think it probably is.
But you know what I'm talking about, right? Like, it's like the parents just stand there, like, staring at him, holding this knife, and they're like, Michael? And then 6 minutes of screen time go by as the camera pans out.
Yeah, that was odd. See, I almost wish that they wouldn't have broken perspective. Like, I almost wish that it had just stayed from his eyes and they wouldn't have had an actor playing him as a kid and then just cut to the title. But
yeah,
whatever.
No, I can see that. That might have been even a little creepier.
Yeah.
Kaysen, now we get 15 years later.
Yes.
We get introduced to Dr. Loomis and Marion Crane, who are going to transfer Michael, right, to a different facility.
Yep.
Let's just talk about Dr. Loomis right off the bat. What do you think of Donald Pleasance's performance as Dr. Loomis? And then we'll get into the sequence of Michael stealing the car.
Yeah, I don't really feel anything about Dr. Loomis. I mean, I guess to be honest, I didn't really like his character. I thought he didn't really do anything.
Now, Kaysen, that's not true. Dr. Loomis hid in the bushes outside of Michael's house for a solid 45 minutes.
That's true.
And then like, remember when he's like, hey, Lonnie, get the hell away from the door. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I like the idea of his character, that there is someone who knows Michael Myers and has known him for a long time and understands how dangerous he is. But I don't know. He's kind of like the Velociraptor guy from Jurassic Park.
Oh, you right? Nailed it. You nailed it. Yeah. But here's the funny thing. I think in this movie, because I've seen all the sequels multiple times, I love this whole franchise, but like in the follow-up movies that Dr. Loomis is in, it's so funny how much more over the top he is. In this movie, if you can believe it, he's actually the most reserved. Like in the sequels, he's way more like, you're dealing with pure evil, you know, like just going like losing his mind.
Yeah, he only gets a couple monologues in this one about how evil Michael is.
Now, here's the thing with Dr. Loomis, too, because you nailed it with the raptor guy. Like, that's a perfect callback to our breakdown of Jurassic Park. Dr. Loomis treats Michael. Now, keep in mind, Michael is a lunatic, but he only killed one person. Right. Dr. Loomis is acting like this is like the New Zealand shooter that like went on some mass rampage with an assault rifle or something. It's like, hey, calm down, dude. He's like, I look behind his eyes and I saw pure evil. It's like, okay, I mean.
Yeah, like he stabbed one person as a child.
Yeah, so
you gotta take a chill pill.
We'll get to this moment here soon, but after Michael escapes in the car and Loomis is outside in the rain and he's like, the evil has escaped. It's like, okay, calm down, buddy. He has a one person body count at this point.
Yeah. Hey, he knew.
What do you think of the sequence, though? I thought it was creepy. The way it was filmed, like from inside the car, again, kind of a perspective thing, pouring rain, and just seeing the inmates like wandering around in the rain. That was creepy to me.
Yeah, it was creepy for sure.
Yeah, I like Michael. I like the scene of him like kind of breaking the window, ripping Marion out of the car. Yep. It was cool. So I like the fact they wasted no time. They just got right into it.
Yep, me too.
Kaysen, so then we cut to Loomis losing his mind, screaming about the evil has escaped. He knows Michael's going back to Haddonfield, his hometown, and this is where we cut to the Jamie Lee Curtis show. Kaysen, what do you think of Jamie Lee Curtis as Laurie Strode? Here she is in all her 1970s glory.
She's good. I mean, I like what we got of the character, and I like her performance. You know, she's kind of like the more capable, smart one out of her friends. It's funny because normally you think of the idea of like an intelligent, empowered female protagonist in a horror movie as a somewhat more modern, like, you know, idea or like something that would be used. But I feel like her character in this is actually pretty capable. And I forgot like how resourceful she was and how just likable she was in the movie overall.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. And also, it's funny how this movie, especially because we just ranked the Scream movies, which were so into like the rules of horror movies, how funny is it that Jamie Lee Curtis was clearly the virgin of this movie, right?
Yeah,
and she's,
yeah.
She's the one who escapes. And then obviously later we get the line, I'll be right back from Bob when he goes to get beer. And it's just funny after watching Scream to see kind of how where those rules came from.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, I like Jamie Lee Curtis. I thought she was good. She was super low-key. I didn't really think she had to do too much heavy lifting. But she was very convincing when it came time to like look terrified, look like she was getting stalked. I thought she kind of switched it up and played both parts pretty well.
Yeah, for sure.
Kaysen, check your watch. It's trivia time. A young Jamie Lee Curtis was so disappointed with her performance that she became convinced she would be fired after only the first day of filming. When her phone rang that night and it was John Carpenter on the phone, Curtis was certain it was the end of her movie career. Instead, Carpenter called to congratulate her and tell her he was very happy with the way things had gone. The fact that she was Janet Lee's daughter from Psycho probably didn't hurt either. According to Deborah Hill, one of the producers on the movie, Jamie Lee Curtis was not Carpenter's first choice. She says he wanted the daughter of the person on Lassie.
Wow, there's a lot of weird stuff in that paragraph.
I don't know what to do with that paragraph, Kaysen.
Well, it just goes to show you nepotism in Hollywood is running rampant.
Absolutely. It is kind of awesome, though, that Janet Lee was such an icon in Psycho when she got murdered in the shower, and then her daughter, you know, however many years later, is now iconic for playing Laurie Strode in the Halloween movies.
Yeah, totally.
Kaysen, let's talk about her friends. So first we get introduced to Annie, then we get introduced to Linda, who
We first talk about these total dork little middle school kids or whatever they are that are like these bullies that are making fun of the main kid?
Sure we can, but does this happen already or is it, I mean, it doesn't matter. It happens close
enough.
Oh,
maybe not. I'm sorry.
Let's talk.
I'm going out of order. Go ahead.
Because I wanted to talk about these kids so bad. Let's just talk about them right now. You're exactly right. First off, I need you to do an impression of these middle school bullies.
I can't. What do they say to him? I can't remember like what they're all chanting.
They go, the boogeyman's coming. And then they go, here's what you're remembering. He's going to get you. Going to get you.
It reminded me of something that like we would have practiced for the fifth grade, you know, like grandparents day performance 10 times of like, okay, say it all together. Gonna get you. And they just like went over it. over and over again.
These kids were literally at like the YMCA the day of filming, and John Carpenter's like stoned out of his mind probably, and he's like, hey kids, I want you to chant Gonna Get You and look as dumb as humanly possible.
Oh man.
But yeah, despite how annoying and stupid these kids are bullying our little hero, what's his name? Tommy Wallet or Tommy?
No idea.
Anyway, whatever the little kid that Laurie Strode's babysitting. I think it's Tommy. Hey, can we talk about straight up pissing yourself when that kid runs directly into Michael Myers and we get that classic sound cue of like the wah?
Yeah, that was awesome. That was a really good daylight jump scare.
Very scary. The kid like runs directly into Michael. Michael grabs him by the shoulders. Again, we get all those great shots of just like from the neck down where we're not seeing his face, not seeing what he looks like, but we know he has that mask on because everyone who does see him looks terrified.
Yeah, totally.
This also kind of starts the entire like, you know, 20-minute sequence of Michael just popping up everywhere.
Yeah, like as far as kind of stalking the girls.
Yeah, I thought a lot of this was effective. I thought it was a little overdone. Like they kind of did it a little too much where it's like, okay, how many places can this dude just be randomly standing?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I liked it. I'm sorry for jumping the gun earlier. If you want to talk about her other high school friends, we can. But I particularly liked the scene when he's standing behind the hedges and she sees him. And then he, like, goes behind them and her friend goes up to look for him and he's gone. I thought that was cool.
Yeah, it's so good. And I think one of the strengths of this movie, like, we talked about the shots before, but it's just, like, the kind of slower, long shots of, like, it's not, like, quickly edited, like, cut, you know? It's just, like,
right.
A lot of, like, you see him standing there and then step behind the bush, right? And then you follow her all the way to the bushes as she looks behind it. And it's just like those long shots to me are more effective than these quick kind of MTV style like flashes.
Sure.
But yeah, let's talk about the character of Annie and let's talk about Linda. What did you think of these two characters? Did you think Linda was totally cool?
I didn't think either of them were totally cool, but I did think they were entertaining. Like I liked them in the movie as just being kind of random goofballs.
Yeah, I thought they were okay. I honestly don't have too much to say about them. Linda is obviously the stereotypical kind of ditzy blonde, and then Annie was a little bit more of kind of the take charge, no bullshit type character. I thought they were both fine. I mean, obviously Linda was super over the top, totally over the top, but yeah. They were fine.
It was hard for me to separate, like, at first, during that long tracking shot of all of them walking home from school while they were talking, I really thought their performances were not very good. But then, over the course of the scene, I kind of started to feel like maybe they were good, and that's just actually how people talked, like, in the 1970s. You know what I mean? I was having trouble, like, getting the vibe for it, but I think maybe once I just got used to the way they were acting, I was, like, in it, and I didn't really notice anymore.
Hey, I don't know if you also noticed this kind of like similarity between this movie and Scream, again, because we just watched this, but didn't you notice how it's kind of a similar setup where like our main character, Jamie Lee Curtis, goes home after school or whatever, and she has this downtime at home where she starts kind of freaking out a little bit. She thinks she sees Michael like behind the clothes, like on the hanging there.
Yeah.
And then she like gets the call from her friend, Annie, right? Who's like, I'm going to come and pick you up, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then that's kind of how Sydney was in Scream, right? Like she gets the call from Tatum of like, I'm going to rent some movies and like, blah. It was like, I just noticed that similarity there where it's like they both kind of go to their house alone, no parents home, and kind of have this like creepy hallucination type thing.
Yeah. No, that's true.
Anyway, Kaysen, we got to talk about the scene, and we're not going to go beat by beat because that's not fun for anybody. But let's talk about the scene where Annie and Laurie are in the car smoking pot. Can you tell me what the hell is going on as far as Annie and Laurie are smoking pot, and then they see her dad, who's a cop, right?
Yeah.
And Annie's like, oh my gosh, it's my dad. Like, put it out. Oh no. And she's freaking out. But she drives the car up to the dad. The dad is not even like beckoning her, calling them over, standing there. She literally could just drive past him, like completely unassuming, right?
Yeah.
Instead, she drives the pot-filled car up to the curb and like starts talking to her dad. I'm like, why did you do that?
Yeah, I didn't even really register that. I guess I thought that they were like going to meet him or like talk to him anyway or something, or maybe he saw them.
Well, if they were going to meet him, why would they be toking in the car?
Yeah,
like
I don't know.
Hunter Biden?
Who knows?
Anyway, Kaysen, so yeah, we get the introduction to these teenagers, all kind of dopey. Everyone but Lori wants to bone down, and that's just how it goes.
Yeah.
Kaysen, now we get Loomis coming back into the picture, losing his shit, trying to warn the local sheriff about the impending doom. First off, what do you think of Loomis coming back and in discovering, when he goes to the cemetery, discovering that Judith Myers, the sister, her gravestone is MIA?
Yeah, that was cool. That was a nice touch. Especially with the payoff later, but
it's also hilarious how the guy who's like showing him where like the gravestone is, he like doesn't put two and two together. Like, okay, here's this guy looking for Judith Myers' gravestone. And then he goes to where the gravestone is, and he's like, these damn kids, like, they're always causing havoc. And
yeah,
Dr.
Yeah.
Loomis is like, whose grave is it? And he's like, well, 18, 19? Oh, my God, it's Judith Myers.
Yeah, he's a little oblivious, too.
Whoops, sorry, lost you there. But, yeah, so I thought this whole thing with Loomis was okay. It was a little bit like, Loomis just seems so sure of himself, like this is where Michael's going, and I guess we just have to accept it because he was his doctor for however long.
Oh, yeah, he knows him.
And then I don't know when this scene comes into play, but we also get the scene where they go to the old Michael Myers house and they discover the dead dog.
Oh, right? Yeah.
But, like, why? I don't understand. Like, this is another one of those things, like, I don't need to understand, but, like, why is Michael eating animals?
I don't think we're supposed to know.
Yeah, Loomis is like, he got hungry. And it's like, okay, couldn't he just eat like a potato?
Yeah, you'd think he'd have access to more food.
So I didn't really get that, but I did like just walking through that house again. I like going upstairs to the bedroom and kind of like Loomis telling the sheriff, like, this is where it happened. She was sitting right here. And this is where we kind of get that Loomis monologue where he says, like, you know, I met him when he was six. And basically, I tried for, what, like 7 years to fix him. And then when I realized I couldn't, I tried for the remaining 8 years to make sure he never, ever, like, got out.
Right.
It's like, well, you failed, dipshit. He stole a car.
Yep. Guess your entire life was was a big failure.
Hey, also another thing. How do you think Michael knows how to drive a car?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I don't know. Maybe he's like a genius.
Now, in the sequels, they kind of explain this a little bit. But it's, yeah, I mean, I like to imagine when Loomis was driving him to his, like, wherever, like his hearings and stuff, he maybe was just focused up on how Loomis was driving.
Yeah, probably. Taking notes.
Anyway, Kaysen, let's get right into the babysitting because now we got these girls. They're watching some kids and they're trying to get pwned up with their boyfriends. But and Laurie Strode wants to hook up with Ben Tramer. She says,
"Oh gosh, not Ben Tramer."
Anyway, Kaysen, it's time to babysit.
It's better than Linda's boyfriend, Bob Sims.
Oh my gosh, dude. Hey, I can't wait. We'll get to that scene in a little bit because that dialogue is cringe on a level that almost doesn't even exist.
Dude, Bob Sims was giving me some Jeff Goldblum vibes.
Life finds a way.
Yeah, I'm making a lot of Jurassic Park comparisons here.
I like it. Anyway, Kaysen, let's start with Annie. Let's just talk about this entire sequence. I love this sequence so much because it is so, so drawn out. Like you mentioned, like you thought the movie just started or like not a lot happened. I feel like part of that is because once night hits and these people are like actually in the houses, we got Lori babysitting Tommy. We have Annie babysitting Lindsay. It's like, man, these sequences are long. And
yeah,
I feel
they
like
are.
seeing Michael walking around, stalking his prey, all of this stuff is so great to me. I love the stuff with Annie. I love him, like, looking at her, all the shots we get of him kind of in the background, like in the window. You just see that glimpse of the mask, right? But we haven't seen it yet in its full glory.
Yeah, and these are the examples of when, like you said, the direction and the camera work really start to come out. Like, there's some great use of kind of, you know, misdirection and, like, making you focus on something in the foreground, but then Michael appears in the background, and then the camera pans back over, and he's gone. Like, I love stuff like that. Really creepy.
Really ominous stuff. Now, let's talk about the scene in question that we mentioned earlier. So, Annie is talking on the phone to Lori, right? She spills something on her clothes. We don't know what it is. Like, I don't
it's
even...
It's popcorn butter.
Popcorn butter.
Yeah.
So she spills this on her clothes and she immediately just takes off all of her clothes except her underwear.
Yeah, like she needs to immediately wash it or the butter is just going to ruin her threads.
It was like she got Team America vomited on. Like it was like whatever the worst thing you can imagine, it was on her clothes. And it's like, hey, calm down. It's popcorn butter. She was ripping off her clothes like they were covered in murder hornets. So I thought this was weird, and you're right. Maybe a little pervy on the part of John Carpenter, but Kaysen, it was the 70s. That's how it was.
Yeah, I guess so.
Everyone was a raging pervert.
Yep.
Anyway, so we get this sequence where she goes out into this separate, like, kind of, like, back shack area with the washer and dryer.
Uh-huh.
How creepy was this sequence?
It was great. I love the restraint. Like, I really thought something crazy was going to happen, and it really doesn't.
Yeah, it's so clever how he keeps flashing back from, like, Michael's perspective to, like, showing us Annie, because you just know Michael is creeping around, right? Like,
yep.
You know he's somewhere there, and the fact that, like, he has that restraint that you mentioned and nothing happens. She totally escapes the situation. Not only that, when she locks herself into the laundry room and then she starts trying to climb out the window and then the little girl, Lindsay, comes out, it's like, oh my gosh, now he's going to kill the little girl.
I know. I was thinking that too.
So great. So cool how that kind of just came and went with just some traces of Michael, but no murder. And then, obviously, we'll flash forward a little bit. We finally get the demise of Annie when she's in her car. Awesome sequence. I don't know if you noticed this. Did you pick up on how she tried to open the car door, realized that she didn't have the keys, right?
Right, yep.
She goes and gets the keys, comes back to the car, and doesn't even think, just opens the door, and it opens.
Yes, yeah. That was cool. I did notice that.
Yeah, she gets in the car. It's like deathly quiet. And then she just has that brief moment of realization, right? Of like, wait, what?
Yep.
And then boom, Michael, backseat, strangulation. I don't know how you felt. I thought this scene was super brutal for the fact it wasn't violent, but it was visceral. It was like you were actually watching someone get choked to death.
It was, and I feel like this scene really makes the point of how strong he is. Like, you know, I feel like it gives off that vibe of like, wow, this guy is like a superhuman. Because wasn't he just holding her with one hand, like from around the seat, and she like could not get away from him?
Yeah, and then I didn't even remember this from like back in the day watching this movie. Does he eventually just take out a knife and like cut her throat?
Yes, yep. And then she kind of falls onto the car horn. And this is after she had already taken the girl, Lindsay, to go be babysat by Jamie Lee Curtis with the boy.
Good call. So Lindsay's out of the picture. Lindsay's over with Lori and the little boy, Tommy. And Annie is dead in a Cadillac. So,
yep.
Not a good ending. Kaysen, let's flash over, no pun intended, to Linda and Bob. They got one thing on their mind. They're trying to do the Scooby Dooby, and they're trying to do the hanky spanky.
Yeah, they are.
That's code for smoking pot and having sexual intercourse.
That is definitely what they're focused on. You're right.
So this entire sequence, why don't you talk to me about this? What do you think of everything happening with Bob and Linda? I have a lot of thoughts. I want to get your thoughts first.
I love it. I mean, from the point when Bob goes downstairs to get the beer, and Michael comes into the picture, like, it's awesome. I love the reveal of him being in that door. Like, I feel like they waited just long enough to have him pop out, and then, well, I don't know how I feel about him being able to, like, hang him on the wall by that knife. That's a little unrealistic, but it was cool. And then I love him in the ghost costume, you know, kind of throwing off Linda, who is obviously pretty ditzy and stupid, but hey, she was somewhat inebriated.
Yeah, as far as him killing Bob, I mean, I agree it's illogical, but that's such an iconic shot of him standing there just staring at Bob's pinned body to the wall.
Yeah.
Really cool stuff there. And then obviously the murder of Linda, choking her out with the phone cord. That was great. Again, creepy as hell because Lori can hear her on the other end of the line.
Yeah, what do you think of Lori's reaction to this?
Incredibly weird because here's the thing. To me, the obvious, it's not even a joke, the obvious place you would go with that is that Lori would think they were having sex.
I completely agree. I was so, like, mystified by this.
But instead, the dialogue is somehow Lori saying, like, oh, like, you're trying to prank me with your squealing noises?
Yeah.
It's like, I mean, yeah.
Maybe that's what she was implying, was, like, that she was trying to make her think they were having sex. I don't know. But it didn't come across that way, really.
Also, before we get into, because this is the first time, before we get into the first time, we really get the full view of the Michael Myers mask as he's listening to Lori on the phone, right? Or he's holding the phone up to his face.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the dialogue between Bob and Linda after they do the pump and dump.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the dialogue when they're arguing about who's going to get the beer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is cringe on a level that I can't explain. Like, Linda is like, you going to get me a beer, Bob? And Bob's like, no, I don't want to get the beer. Why don't you get the beer? And Linda's like, come on, Bob. Is that all you can say? Yeah. I'm butchering it, but no pun intended. But do you agree it was incredibly uncomfortably awkward?
Yep, it was pretty rough, but I honestly didn't even mind at this point.
See, here's the other thing. Michael in the ghost thing, I don't know if I like that or not, because it was a cool visual, but it was also like, that doesn't seem like him, does it?
Yeah, like out of character. That seems more like a Ghostface thing, not a Michael Myers thing.
Yeah, that's a Ghostface thing before he got kicked in the balls 7 times, hit with a brick over the head, and then fell down and got arthritis in his left knee.
Yeah. Hey, Michael takes some punishment in this movie, too.
He does. Yeah, you're right. But anyway, so yeah, love the Bob Linda thing. Both cool kills, both showing Michael. Kaysen, let's talk about the first time we get this mask. When he's holding the phone up, we finally get the full view of Michael's face. I don't know how you feel. I feel like this is terrifying. I think this mask is iconic for a reason. and I feel like it's the perfect representation of this movie, which is streamlined, like simple and terrifying. It's not too over the top. It's not too anything. It's just to the point.
Yeah, I think it's perfect too, because the mask really doesn't even look like anything. Like, it's just a mask, you know, like it looks humanoid.
Kaysen,
really weird.
It's funny you say that because my watch is telling me it's trivia time.
Oh, no.
In the documentary short film Halloween Unmasked, it was revealed that the crew had chosen 2 masks for Michael Myers to decide on. The first was a Don Post Emmett Kelly smiling clown mask that they put frizzy red hair on.
You're kidding.
This was an homage to how he killed his sister Judith in a clown costume, which makes sense, actually. They tested it out, and it appeared very demented and very creepy.
Okay.
The other mask was a 1975 Captain James T. Kirk from Star Trek mask that was purchased for around $1. It had the eyebrows and sideburns ripped off, the face was painted fish belly white, and the hair was spray painted brown, and the eyes were opened up a little bit more. They tested out the Kirk mask, and the crew decided it was much more creepy because it was emotionless. This became the Michael Myers mask.
Wow, that's actually amazing.
So Michael Myers, The Mask, is based on William Shatner as Captain Kirk. Did you ever see that trivia time coming, Casey?
No, I never knew that. That's amazing.
I think they nailed it. I mean, this to me is the creepiest slasher in that I've ever seen. Like, scarier than Jason, scarier than Freddy. Because again, it's so like ominous. It's not over the top like Freddy. It's not like kind of corny, like wearing a hockey mask like Jason. You know what I mean? It's just creepy.
Yeah, it's just like a dude who means business.
Exactly. Kason, this leads us, let's just get into it. Let's get right into the final showdown with Laurie versus Michael.
Okay.
Now, we should mention, Loomis is still just hanging around the bushes outside of Michael's old house. He's been there for about an hour of screen time.
Yeah, just keeping an eye on things.
Exactly. Just making sure nothing happens, being completely worthless. And yeah, we get Laurie versus Michael. Kason, this starts when Laurie decides, after hearing the squealing noises, decides to go over and investigate what the hell is going on. Now, we should mention, before we get into Laurie versus Michael, Tommy, the little boy, I love these moments of him seeing Michael across the street.
Oh, yeah, me too. The boogeyman.
Constantly crying about the boogeyman. Nobody believes him. Laurie thinks he's a dope that needs some Ritalin. And yeah, I love, again, creepy, ominous POV shots of like Tommy looking out the window, seeing Michael like carrying Annie's body, etc. It's creepy stuff.
Yeah, totally.
So Laurie goes over to investigate. Kason, what do you think of this entire sequence when she discovers the House of Horrors with all of her friends butchered?
It's awesome. I love the use of the gravestone in the bed. Again, like, it is similar to the ghost thing. I guess you have to ask the question, like, does this really feel like Michael Myers to, like, set up this big, you know, Hannibal Lecter-style, like, art piece? but I don't know. It's cool. Like, I guess he likes kind of toying around with his prey.
I guess the other thing, too, like, which I just have to mention, is, like, thinking about it now, rewatching it and stuff, what is the, I know we talked about there is no point to Michael Myers, but like, what is he doing? You know, he's just kind of like walking around. Like, why did he pick these females? Because maybe they remind him of his sister? I don't know.
Well, I can't tell if it was like he had chosen Jamie Lee Curtis from the beginning and everything else he was doing was just kind of like a setup to her. Or if he really was just kind of randomly walking around the neighborhood, like, killing people.
Now, you know, obviously, in the sequel, we get an answer on that. Spoiler alert, if you don't want to know. But they reveal that Michael and Jamie are brother-sister.
Right,
Michael and Lori. I think that's bullshit. I like, again, just the simplistic idea that there is no rhyme or reason.
Yeah.
But if you want to go into the sequels, they kind of bring that up. But anyway, yeah, maybe a little out of character that he's so elaborate, kind of setting up these like haunted house things for Laurie to find, but still effective.
Yeah, definitely.
Kason, now we get to me one of the most iconic shots in horror movie history. This is so brilliant and so perfectly done. I can't imagine watching like the footage of this after you shot it and being like, "We got it." This is so incredible when Jamie Lee Curtis is standing in the doorway, like just taking in the horror of her friends being killed in the background, pitch black. And what do we see slowly come into frame? Michael's iconic white mask, just like piercing through the darkness. It is so awesome, so beautiful. And this starts the horror of Laurie versus Michael.
Yep, I agree. That was perfectly done.
Yeah, and also the stab, he like stabs her in the arm. That's brutal. It like makes me uncomfortable watching that.
Yeah, I mean, this is where it starts to get like pretty back and forth between them. Like they're kind of, well, it's not like they're evenly matched, but I guess it's more just like he can't really finish her off and she can't really finish him off. But he's very slow. Like, he's not really in a hurry to do it, you know?
Yeah, so basically he stabs her in the arm, pushes her over the banister, and then that's when we get the scene. See, I don't understand. Why was the door locked? Why could she not get out of the front door of the house?
I'm trying to remember. Wasn't there like he put like a rake there or something, right? Doesn't she have to break the glass and like reach through and move it?
Yeah, but that's in like that side room. Like first, before she even goes into that room, she tries to go out the front door and like she can't open it. And I remember thinking on rewatch, like, why?
Oh, why, I don't know. She not? I don't know.
So that was kind of weird, but she runs into the side room. Yeah, he blocked the door with the rake. Or did he do that, or was that something Annie did? I don't know. It doesn't matter. But basically, the door is blocked. That's when we get the scene you had mentioned earlier, Kaysen, with the music. Doo-doot.
Yep.
Doo-doot. As he's like, again, such a great job of just showing him slowly moving. And this is one of the things, even though there's criticism about this and people kind of make fun of it now, of having a slow-moving villain.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It feels more like impending doom, like slow impending doom, because you can't get out of this situation and he's slowly approaching instead of just rapidly sprinting at you.
Right, right, right.
So this whole sequence was fantastic. It's like the
It Follows thing.
Perfect. Similar concept. Nailed it. Yeah, Kaysen, why don't you go into the scene you were talking about earlier? I know you already briefed us on it, but Lori running back across the street. First, we got to mention she tries to go to the neighbor's house, right?
Yeah, see, this is one thing that I did not like.
I totally agree.
Like, it didn't make any sense at all to me. Like, what kind of heartless, soulless neighbors are like looking at this high school girl screaming, pounding on the door, and like shutting the blinds? That didn't make any sense. And then it also didn't make any sense that she would just give up and run away. Like, are you kidding me? You would get a rock and like break their window or something, right? And get in there.
Yeah, it made absolutely no sense. Like, was the idea that they thought she was like playing a trick on them, or she was some like punk teenager that was just BSing?
I have no idea. I mean, it must be.
Super weird. And then the other weird thing is she runs off their porch, and I'm like, why would you go back to the house with the kids?
Right, right, like, right. Yeah.
That's the least responsible thing you could do. I mean, considering the dude is not a runner, he's clearly not Carl Lewis out there sprinting around.
Yeah, keep running to another neighbor's house. I mean, she's in a neighborhood, right?
Exactly. So kind of some boneheaded decisions made by Jamie. Maybe she was thinking about Ben Tramer a little too much.
Yeah.
But yeah, we get the shot. Why don't you tell me again about this scene you like so much, where she's pounding on the door trying to wake up Tommy's dumbass who's asleep in bed?
Yeah, Tommy's like waddling his way to the front door as slow as possible as she's screaming and pounding on it. You'd think he'd move a little faster after he was just screaming about seeing the boogeyman like five times that night. But she keeps... Just saying. She keeps looking over her shoulder and seeing Jason just slowly walking across the street.
You just called him Jason. I need you to apologize.
Oh, shoot. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. Michael Myers. You know what I meant. Slowly walking across the street. And the camera just keeps cutting back and forth between showing her pounding on the door and then just showing him like getting closer and closer to the camera. And it really just builds that feeling of like, you're trapped, which was an incredible effect, but again, kind of dumb because she really wasn't trapped at all. Like, she could have just run anywhere else.
Yeah, it's like the equivalent of when something's falling in a movie and the characters, instead of running left or right, they run straight and let it crush them.
Exactly.
This reminded me, we mentioned in our top 10 horror movies, The Orphanage, obviously one of our favorite movies. Didn't this remind you of the knocking scene in that movie where like, every time our protagonist turns around, the threat is like a little bit closer.
Yeah.
A little bit closer.
Yeah.
And it's like, man, that's such an uneasy feeling. Great stuff. Great sequence. So she gets in the house, tells the kids, hey, hide your dumbasses in the closet or something. I don't know what she tells these kids, but she tells them to hide. Michael comes in. This is actually an amazing sequence because she goes in the house. She can't find Michael anywhere. She thought she locked him outside, but she notices the window is open, right?
Yep.
And like there's a breeze coming through and she knows he's in the house.
Yeah. And then I feel like she just internally implodes and like, doesn't she just kind of go into a fetal position like by the couch?
Yeah, she goes into the fetal position. This is when we realize that Michael Myers has the athletic capability of me in third grade, because He pulls the butcher knife out. He has the jump on her, right? And he misses. She doesn't even do anything. He just, like, stabs the couch cushion. It's like, hey, who's under the mask? Ray Charles?
Yeah, it's not his best night.
Oh, man. Yeah, he was a little off his game. I guess he hasn't sliced and diced for 15 years. But I'm like, Michael, come on, dude. You had a clean shot. So he misses like a dope. She takes out her knitting thing, whatever it is, in her purse.
Yeah.
Stabs the dude in the neck, which is pretty sweet.
Yeah, definitely.
He falls down. We think it's lights out. I mean, obviously, we know better because we've seen other horror movies. But she thinks it's lights out, and she makes the worst mistake anybody could make in a horror movie. What does she do, Kaysen?
Turns around. Turns her back on
him. Well, that is a mistake. But what does she do with his weapon of choice?
Oh, leaves it there.
She leaves it there like a dipshit. I thought she's supposed to be the scholarly one, and she's doing things like dropping the butcher knife on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Kaysen, Lori runs upstairs, gets the kids, says, hey, everything's okay. And Tommy says, what about the boogeyman? And Lori says, it's okay. I killed the boogeyman.
As she's walking up the stairs behind
us, we see him in the background walking up the stairs. We get the incredible line from Tommy. The only line this dipshit kid says in the whole movie that's amazing. You can't kill the boogeyman.
Yep.
And then immediately cuts to Michael and immediately cuts to the da-da, da-da. Yep. And it's like, oh my gosh, dude.
This is cool too, because you can kind of just vaguely see him in the corner walking up the stairs first, and then the camera just kind of moves to where he's like fully in the shot. It's cool.
Great camera work from John Carpenter. Lori, like, I mean, look, let's be real. Lori, she's supposed to be scholarly, despite the answer she gave earlier in her class on fate. I think she's a little slow.
Well, here she has a good idea though, right?
What? She runs into the closet.
Yeah, but isn't it after she opens the window? Like, opens the door to outside?
Yeah, I can't remember. Does she do that because she's trying to go outside or she's trying to trick him?
I thought she was trying to trick him because she tells the two kids to go hide, and then she goes and opens the door leading outside, and then she goes and hides in the closet. And I thought what she was trying to do is make him think she went out the window when really she's hiding in the closet.
Okay, I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt and just defer to you on that.
Let's imagine that's what she was trying to do.
She's in the closet. Obviously, some cheap-ass fake plywood is no match for Michael Myers' fists of fury. This dude breaks through the closet like Chuck Norris breaking through skulls, just wrecking this closet door.
Yeah.
Now, in one of the most... This should be on Mythbusters, Kaysen. This should really be on Mythbusters. Can you take a old 1970s hanger, right?
And then with the accuracy of a, you know, seasoned Hawkeye, exactly.
Wow.
Stab Michael Myers directly in his eyeball through the mask.
Right in his friggin' eye, dude. Now if this was Scream, she would have like stabbed him in the balls. But it's not. So she stabs him in the eye, Kaysen. He's staggered. He's messed up. Now, I can't remember. Oh, no. Okay, she stabs him in the eye, and then she takes his knife that he drops and straight up shanks him.
Yep, that's right.
This was pretty awesome. Now, here's where I want to point out, again, the genius of John Carpenter. Michael goes down for the count. He's laying on his back looking like, down goes Frasier. Most movies nowadays, I was thinking this as I was watching it, as Lori is climbing out of the closet, walking past Michael, most movies would have all these cuts of like super close up, like Lori's feet, like slowly walking by his head. You know what I mean? All this stuff. I love just the simple, like still shot of just the room. You know, it never moves. We see Michael laying there. We see Lori. It just feels, I'm not saying one is necessarily better than the other. Mm-hmm. I just like seeing different shit sometimes. And I feel like it's refreshing to see just a steady shot of just this scene playing out.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. I agree.
No quick cuts, nothing like that. Her creeping by him, so good. she tells the kids, hey, for the second time, come out of here and clean your diapers. Because this time for real, I killed the boogeyman.
Wouldn't she think she would know better at this point? Like, come on.
We're going to get to that, Kaysen. So okay. The kids run out. The kids run down the street screaming like hyenas. And Loomis just happens to get out of the Michael Myers bushes long enough to hear these kids.
Yeah.
So he's like, oh, shit, kids screaming? I bet Michael's in there.
I found him.
Now, here's the thing, Kaysen. This scene is the most iconic scene in the movie to me. Obviously, it's the end of the movie. But what is Laurie doing? The only thing I can chalk it up to is post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
Like, she's just on a different plane of existence right now. But why are you sitting in the doorway with your back turned?
Yeah,
any normal, rational human being would exit the house and sit in the middle of the road waiting for help to come.
Yep. Or like, stab him more times.
But Kaysen. Yeah, exactly. But can we talk about the unbelievable creepiness of no music, no audio, just Laurie sitting there, and in the background, what do we see?
He's back.
Michael sitting up and then turning his head and looking at her. It is so unsettling, so creepy. I love this shot so much. This is a perfect encapsulation of what makes this movie so special. Simple but effective.
Yep. You just can't stop him.
He can't stop, dude. He's the boogeyman. You can't kill the boogeyman. So he comes up, chokes her out like Chris Brown, just going nuts.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
Yeah, sorry. Insensitive. But going crazy, Loomis runs up the stairs with his old ass and his you know, Clint Eastwood revolver, pulls it out, boom, shoots Michael. Dude, we get the shot of Michael's face. What do you think of the decision to actually show us Michael as his mask gets knocked off and he's putting it back on?
Yeah, I don't think I like it, but I kind of respect it. I don't know. I have to kind of decide how I feel about that. Watching the movie, I was like, oh, I wish they wouldn't have done that. But I'm trying to kind of understand the like how it could be good. I don't know. What do you think?
I think it's interesting because you can see where he's coming from. I feel like the decision to show Michael's face briefly kind of came from a place of like, we want to remind people there is a human being under this mask.
Yeah.
That like, he's not just a mythical figure. He is a man. But so like, how is he able to withstand this punishment when we're showing you he's a human being? But I feel like it does take a little bit of the intrigue, a little bit of the otherworldliness away from Michael. So it just depends which side of the aisle you fall on with that.
See, that kind of like ties into my criticism of the beginning of the movie. I almost feel like the whole thing would have been that much more powerful if they had never shown him as a kid, like from afar, and if they had never taken his mask off as an adult. Because I feel like then you get the amazing like, you get the idea that he was a kid because in the beginning you have the opening sequence showing him, you know, kill his family member as a child. But you never actually see him, like, aside from in the mask or from his perspective. And I really like that idea, right? That you know, like, he was a kid, now he's an adult, so you know he must be a person. But, like, also, like, what is this thing? You know, like, who is this guy? Like, I don't know. I kind of wish it would have just been more mysterious.
Yeah, like, I totally get that. Like, it would have made him even more kind of intriguing and just more like, is this a human being in there?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
So I get both sides of it. But yeah, Loomis caps this dude, ends up shooting him 6 times, falls off the balcony. Jamie Lee delivers the great line, that was the boogeyman. And Loomis says, as a matter of fact, it was.
Yep.
Awesome dialogue right there. And then sure as shit, Loomis goes to check on the body. Do you think it's there?
Or it's gone.
Do you think it's gone?
It's gone. He's driving to Florida. Done with this.
Michael Myers is like Philip Phillips. He's gone, gone, gone.
Wow, you're actually 3 times. You're right.
It's a deep cut.
Yeah.
So Michael's gone. Loomis just starts spazzing out, having a mild aneurysm. And Laurie just knows. She knows from Loomis's reaction, oh shit, now I'm going to have to film a sequel.
No.
Kaysen, and how awesome are these closing shots of the movie? Just like flashing around, almost like just giving the audience again that feeling that Michael is everywhere. He's like all encompassing. He could be here. He could be there. He's everywhere.
Yeah, really cool. Really cool.
Great ending. Really cool stuff. And that's Halloween. That is the one that kind of started it all.
I mean, is it really the one that started it all? Like, I'm trying to think, like, again, as far as slashers go, kind of?
No, it's not. Because obviously Psycho. You have, like, Psycho, yeah. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. But it's, like, it's still, I feel like, the one that really put it on the map, you know?
And yeah,
the one that kind of, like, made it be this thing that people would copy for decades to come.
Yeah. I mean, and maybe it was the first one that had someone, like, creeping around people's houses where they were living, like, killing them.
Maybe.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, there's. I'm sure there's other examples of that that I'm just not understanding or not up
aware
on.
Of. But yeah,
Kaysen, one thing I totally forgot to mention. Can we please mention the Bob and Linda dialogue when Bob reveals himself to be a pedophile by saying they're going to take off Lindsay's clothes when she's a little girl?
Oh yeah, that was weird.
What the hell is going on with Bob and Linda?
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he was trying to give them a reason to be axed.
Exactly. Kaysen, also, I want to ask you a question, because we both, I know I loved the 2018 sequel, reimagining, remake, whatever you want to call it, of Halloween.
Yeah.
Really love that, especially after rewatching this. It's just such a nice, like, companion piece to this movie.
Yep.
What do you think of, like, comparing this ending with Jamie versus Michael? How much more satisfying now is it refreshing yourself on this one, thinking of that 2018 ending?
Yeah, really, really cool. I mean, honestly, it makes me want to watch that one again.
So good. Because spoilers, like, for, you know, we're going to spoil the ending if you haven't seen the 2018 Halloween. But one of the coolest parts of that ending in the Michael versus Laurie kind of sequel fight is just the idea that in that movie, Laurie is the one who gets wrecked, right? And falls. Did she fall off the balcony?
I don't know if she falls off the balcony or I can't remember, honestly. I know I the whole know house is like exploding.
I just know they totally flipped the script and Laurie gets wrecked. And when Michael goes to like check on her body, she's the one who vanished.
Yeah, and
they do kind of like a mirror image of the end of the original Halloween where Michael's the one who vanished. And I love that so much.
Yep, I like that a lot too.
Really cool stuff. So anyway, that's Halloween. Kaysen, closing thoughts on the movie? Anything else you have to say?
I don't think so. I feel like we covered it pretty well, but yeah, I really liked it. I mean, I'm glad that I think we're pretty on the same page about it, at least in terms of the things we liked and disliked about it. I think maybe you just like it, or maybe you hold it in higher esteem than I do, but I mean, that's fine with me. I feel like we're on the same page.
I think one of the problems with this movie that is unfortunate is that this movie has been sequelized in its own franchise, like to death.
Yeah.
And so many other movies have copied it, taken the best parts of it, eliminated the worst parts. You know, it's just one of those things where it's been picked apart to death. And it's almost like this really is one of those movies, even though I know you hate hearing this, Kaysen. You have to view this through the lens of when it came out and why it was so special at that time. Because now it's just been so, like, been there, done that. I've seen this, like, slasher thing. But even with that being said, I still feel like John Carpenter is doing things in this movie that very few have kind of recreated.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think those specific aspects of it still do hold up. And I think that's where the minimalism of the movie really helps it. Like, because I think that helps it hold up even after 40 years, you know?
Yeah. So. Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff, good stuff. It, again, like, it's almost so minimalistic that it felt like a really long TV episode to me. But that's not really even a knock on it, you know? Like, that's just, it is what it is. Like, I would have loved seeing this in a theater. It would have been an awesome time.
Yeah, maybe it will get re-released in the pandemic case. Yeah, we'll
the final movie. Yeah.
Anyway, that was Halloween. We watched this on AMC Plus with a free trial. So if you do want to check it out after hearing us talk about it, you can sign up for a free trial of AMC Plus and check it out.
That's right. We are not sponsored by AMC.
No, I'm not sponsored by The Walking Dead season 15.
Right, right. But we're waiting on our cameo opportunities for Better Call Saul final season. So get to us, AMC.
Please call me. Kaysen, October was a fun month for us. We had some good episodes. We had some good times. What do you think is next for the show? Again, season 2, who the hell knows when that's coming?
I don't know, man.
Still waiting, but...
Maybe a Charlie Brown Thanksgiving?
You know what's funny? You mentioned Thanksgiving. Here's what I was thinking. I don't know. Don't etch this into stone, but maybe we could do like a cool quarantine episode around Thanksgiving time, and we could do like things we're thankful for in like the entertainment industry, you know?
Oh, okay. Sure.
That might be kind of a light and breezy episode. We could recap some of the things we saw. I know we both checked out Borat recently and some other stuff on streaming. So yeah, maybe
that
we'll
probably
do something.
Wouldn't make my list of things I'm thankful for. But
oh hell no, I'm not saying thankful for. I'm just saying like we'll recap what we've been watching.
Oh sure.
And then in addition to that, we'll maybe drop some things we're thankful for in the movie television space.
Yeah, I like that. We'll see. We'll make it work.
I'm thankful for Elizabeth Banks making The Invisible Woman.
We all are.
Anyway,
I'm thankful for Soul coming to Disney Plus on Christmas Day.
Let's go. We're watching that together for sure.
I can't wait.
I hope our parents appreciate that more than they did Inside Out.
Let's not even talk about that.
Anyway, everyone have a fantastic Halloween. Hope you had a great October, and we will keep you posted on the future of this show. We're always thinking and always planning. Season 2 is coming. We just don't know when, but it is coming. Don't worry.
Yep. Stay safe, everyone. Drink your cider. Eat your donuts. Enjoy fall before the Joe Biden warned dark of winter arrives.
Hey, also, Kaysen, the episode's over, and I don't think I have COVID still.
Oh, thank goodness. We made it.
I took some Revergeron and bleach, and I'm feeling... Kaysen, I'm feeling 20 years younger.
Good, good. You know, those doctors at Walter Reed, they really know what they're doing.
Great, the best. Anyway, on that note,
all right.
Have a fantastic evening. Good night.
Good night.